Oxide Radio, Oxford University's only student-run radio station.
Hello and welcome to Oxide Radio. This is Theo Davis-Lewis on Oxford Today. So far, we've spoken to different characters from around Oxford. The director of the Ashmolean, for instance, told us about the future of museums. What does Brexit mean for our heritage management institutions? But also, we've spoken to Chris Patton about his book, Identity in Politics. As well as this, we've also spoken to the librarian of the Bodleian about all things books. You just can't get enough of it. Today, I am speaking to Sir Ivor Roberts, one of the most illustrious diplomats of our age here in the UK and abroad. Amongst other things, Sir Ivor was the ambassador in Dublin and also in Rome. And he's kindly come to speak to us today after he's retired recently from Trinity College as the president. So, Sir Ivor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we were just saying that before going on air that there's so much to talk about, just with diplomacy and your own career. And perhaps it's best to start with this week and the international relations we see in Europe at this moment, you know, Catalonia, Spain. You were stationed in Madrid as well a few decades ago. What's your assessment of what's going on, but also the diplomatic tension and the failings, perhaps, between the Spanish government, the Catalonian government, and the EU as a whole?
Quite a big question. The Spanish crisis is reaching its peak now, and I can't quite work out how it's going to evolve, but I think it's going to be very unpleasant. Mr. Puigdemont and the Catalan, ex-Catalan government, I suppose we should now describe them, are not going to take kindly or lightly to being sacked. And I think there will be street protests, there will be protests from the other side, from the pro-union, as I suppose we'll call them, pro-Spanish side. I think the trouble is that Catalonia is very deeply split. I suspect that if there were a proper referendum, it would work out a bit like the Scottish referendum, about 60-40 or 55-45 in favour of staying with Spain. And we'll see what happens in the elections, although my hunch is that the Catalan nationalists will boycott them because they fear that they would lose. I think in terms of international consequences, the European Union has set their face against secession. If they didn't, then I think you'd be talking about a European Union of about 120 countries, because you'd get the fragmentation of countries like Italy, Belgium, the United Kingdom, of course. If they don't hold the line and say, you know, we deal with the current nation states and we look to their unity rather than fragmentation, I think it will, Europe would become ungovernable.
And, you know, you were saying earlier as well, when you were in Madrid, I think it was between 1989 and the early 90s, you know, the issue was Basque terrorism, really.
Absolutely, yes. That was one of my major preoccupations, because I'd come from a background, I'd been head of counter-terrorism in the Foreign Office just before I went to Madrid. So terrorism was very much on my mind. And of course it became an issue later on when I was ambassador in Dublin and had to have 24/7 armed guards.
Yeah. But, you know, how do we, you know, Spain's a sort of a funny country, just focusing on them for a second. You know, there's sort of a funny history, because some have argued, you know, in anthropology, in social sciences, in history, that really they never really escaped Franco's sort of period and his dictatorship and the legacy of Franco. And stemming from, you know, you look at Basque terrorism, and it's a separate issue, and Catalonian independence. But, you know, is there sort of an innate sort of political divide in Spain as a whole, which has sort of been really clear over the last century?
Well, I can't speak for the first half of the century, but I think in my experience of Spain, which goes back to the 70s, my impression was that they recovered pretty well, and they were pretty proud of themselves in their post-Franco period. When I was there as minister, which was number two in the embassy in the late 80s, early 90s, Felipe González, the socialist leader, was prime minister the whole time. And he was from Andalusia, and he did a pretty good job in bringing the country together. There was the threat of Basque terrorism. Basques the Ba'ath terrorist organization ETA was still active. But there was a feeling, helped of course by great prosperity in Spain, it was a golden period for the Spanish economy, of Spain taking its rightful place in Europe for the first time in many decades.
And do you think now then that Spain perhaps is in danger of losing that? Because a lot of people are saying, you know, the youth unemployment in Spain, and this is the crisis they have now, they sort of are sort of dominated by the EU, and many accusations have sort of surfaced that the reason that the EU, as well as many other reasons that they're backing Spain, is because they have so much influence over them, because they, you know, Spain needs the EU.
I don't buy into that. I don't think that's certainly. I mean, I go to Spain quite regularly, about once every 2 months, but I haven't lived there for a couple of decades. But that's not my impression. I don't think they feel that they're being bossed around by the EU. I think they feel that they've got a proper place in Europe, but they do look to the EU to protect the Madrid government clearly look to the EU to preserve their unity and to not to have any truck with Catalan or indeed Basque secession. And I see the British government has followed suit.
But do you think then, just sort of before we move on, do you think that we will get a resolution, or, you know, with Catalan independence? Because you can look at what's happened with Scotland and the parallels you have there. If there was an actual legal referendum, you know, the Scottish independence is still on the cards now, really. Is this something that's going to linger on for a few years, you think?
Well, I don't agree with you that Scottish independence is on the cards. A second referendum may be on the cards, but I think if you had a referendum tomorrow, my impression is that the majority in favour of remaining part of the UK would be even bigger, given the decline in terms of trade as far as oil and other things are concerned. No, so I don't really accept that.
But don't you think that this issue of Catalan independence then is still going to be in public discourse and in current affairs, and it's going to be an issue?
Well, as I said, I mean, I do think people are very divided. The difference, of course, between UK and Spain is that the Spanish constitution specifically rules out separate referenda, rules out independence for particular regions of Spain, in a way which, I mean, I was ambassador in Yugoslavia when it was in the middle of breaking up, of course, and there the constitution specifically allowed each republic to go their own way if they wanted to. So there are these key differences. I think the difficulty in Catalonia is how deeply divided people are, and whatever happens is going to be it's going to be very difficult to heal wounds, and dialogue is going to be very difficult because the Catalans feel that they propose dialogue, and the Spanish government say, well, call off your referendum and your independence declaration and then we'll talk. And of course the Catalan nationalists cling to their 43% referendum of a month ago.
And you talk about division. We don't have to look too far, actually, you know, from this country to see division anyway, because the UK is one of the most divided countries politically, you could say, in Europe. And I think I'm right in saying that you became an Irish citizen after the Brexit vote.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, give us your assessment then. What's, you know, because I get the impression, obviously, that you are sort of pro-Remain and everything like that. What's your impression of what's happening now after the Brexit vote and the sort of state of negotiations and diplomacy here?
Well, the state of negotiations seems to me to be dire, and I think there are two sets of people to blame for that. I think the British side is riven by divisions within the governing party, between those who want a hard Brexit, no deal at all, want to walk away on the 31st of March 2019, have nothing more to do with the European Union, and those who take a very much more moderate and pragmatic view. On the other side, I think the European Commission, and I very much blame the Anglophobe president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, for this. They went to the European Council, the Council of Ministers, and asked to be placed in handcuffs, basically. So their negotiating position was incredibly rigid and inflexible. And this idea of this constant obsession with phasing, you must pay your divorce bill before we'll talk about trade. You must sort out the Northern Ireland question before you talk about trade. How can you sort out the Northern Ireland question unless you know what kind of trading relationship will exist between countries or nations which are part of the United Kingdom and a foreign country? It's entirely unrealistic. It's a self-imposed measure which is deeply unhelpful to any kind of constructive and normal negotiation. So I've never seen a negotiation where one side says we're not prepared to discuss the main issue until we get beyond these preliminaries, of which we will be judge and jury.
So what would you say then if you were in this negotiation and you had, you know, if you spoke to Juncker about this, what would you say to him?
I would say, do you want a deal? If you do want a fair deal for Britain and for the European Union, which is actually happens to be in both sides' interest, you have to abandon this idea of rigid sequencing, and you have to take a more moderate view on what can be achieved without discussing trade.
And people will ask then, as many commentators and broadcasters and reporters do, that there's not going to be a deal. People still believe that there won't be a deal. We will not leave the EU. Do you think that's likely?
I wish it were. I wish we were remaining in the European Union. I think people were sold a series of lies by people like the leading Brexiteers. I think people are only now waking up to the fact that it isn't all going to be hunky-dory in this great new brave new world of freedom, which is all this idea of paddling our own canoe in a globalized world is so wholly unrealistic that it makes one weep. Of course, Oxford was very strongly in the Remain camp, as indeed were Cambridge and London, but it was depressing how poor the Remain campaign was and how they failed to nail the lies of the leading Brexiteers.
So you think probably they will get a bad deal then, just because of, you know, the situation we're in? People thought, well, actually you could say any deal is a bad deal because of the lies you think that the people have told.
Well, I think we're going to be worse off whatever the deal. So I think that's bad, but it's a question of whether we go from bad to worse. And the way we are going, it looks as though it's going to be worse. But I have hopes, and they're only hopes, that the Council of Ministers will finally exert their proper influence and say to Juncker and Barnier, the chief EU negotiator, look, guys, you know, you've got to get a deal. This can't go on like this. And we're going to give you the necessary flexibility to ensure you do. There's another sinister character called Selmayr, Martin Selmayr, who's Juncker's chef de cabinet, who's another Anglophobe, unfortunately has too great an influence, in my view, within the German governing party, the CDU. He's, as you would guess, he is a German. And he was instrumental in getting Angela Merkel to agree to Juncker becoming president of the Commission, a decision that David Cameron celebratedly opposed rigorously and at one stage thought he had Angela Merkel's support. Mm. Anyway, that fell away. Juncker then took over and has never relinquished his dislike of Britain. We've seen these disgraceful leaks of every time Juncker and Barnier sit down to have dinner with Theresa May, there is a distorted and unpleasant and highly personalised leaking, always to the Frankfurter Allgemeine, of what happened at the dinner. I can't imagine that Theresa May is going to enjoy too many more dinners with Barnier and Juncker.
But surely if you discuss the sort of Anglophobia that seems to be, you know, the case in these EU camps, there's a reason, perhaps, that the rhetoric and whatever Nigel Farage, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove claimed, you know, there's a reason why people actually believed that and voted to leave them, because of what's that? People might say this is what they were saying about that they don't respect us, they don't care about us.
Well, I think there's certainly a measure of Anglophobia now in Brussels. You talk to people in Brussels, and they're furious with Britain for basically creating a major crisis without any justification at all. I was at a conference in Italy, and I gave a presentation of the British position somewhere along the lines I was just saying, and criticizing the European Commission's approach. And there were two ex-Italian prime ministers there, and one of them, someone I've always respected greatly, Mario Monti, said he totally disagreed with me, and he thought that the concessions given by the European side to David Cameron before the referendum in the so-called renegotiation had been, quotes, excessively generous. I said to him, well, you may think of them as excessively generous, Mario, but in Britain they were regarded as a bagatelle, a trifle, and cutting no ice at all. And part of the reason why so many people voted no was, as you were saying a moment ago, you know, people had a feeling that the Europeans weren't actually interested in bettering the structure and workings of the European Union in a way which would make it a better organisation.
But do you think that this Anglophobia is because of the vote, or people like Juncker are just
I think Juncker started off. I think Selmayr as well. The two of them are very Anglophobic, and it goes back before the referendum. I think they regarded Britain as a kind of perpetual outlier who would hold back the Europeans from his great federalist dream. You know, there could be no development towards a European army, for instance, because the British would always say no. Britain was never, ever going to join the euro. You know, the whole catalogue of things we were seeing as being a kind of anchor dragging back the free-sailing European ship.
And do you think then the decision to leave the EU from Britain, and whatever deal we get, because people can acknowledge that it's not going to turn out great, do you think then that we will see, as Nigel Farage and everyone else proclaims, that there'll be other countries following suit or not?
I don't see any sign of it so far.
But do you think then, just because of what you said about, you know, this Anglophobia and the treatment from the EU side, that people will sort of try and sort of understand that the EU is not this sort of inclusive environment really for
the country? Well, I think for smaller countries particularly, they'll take a completely different view, which is that, God, look how the European Union treat a country as big and powerful as the UK when they try to withdraw. Imagine the fate we would suffer if we attempted to go the same way.
And perhaps one of the most difficult things for us in this country to actually face when we go into negotiations is the question of Northern Ireland. And you were ambassador there.
No, I was ambassador in Ireland.
Oh, sorry. Ambassador
in Ireland. Can't be ambassador to part of your own country.
Of course. Ambassador in Dublin, at the beginning of the century, really. And you sort of saw what happened with the Good Friday Agreement, and you said that this deal and agreement hasn't gone far enough. And now, as we see the developments north and south of the border, Ireland and Northern Ireland are in such a difficult position now. We've got the DUP sort of in a confidence and supply deal with Britain, and everyone's written and said things they want to say about that. Is there sort of a constitutional crisis happening now, you know, linked to Brexit and Northern Ireland and the question of a hard border? Are these things which seriously jeopardise, you know, the outcome of this negotiation as well as the future of the UK?
Well, there's no doubt that Ireland and Northern Ireland, the Republic and Northern Ireland's future relationship is a huge complicating factor, both in the Brexit negotiations and in the constitutional future of the UK as we move forward with the Good Friday Agreement, though, of course, at the moment it's completely stymied by the refusal of the parties to make power sharing work. And today is actually happens to be a critical day for that, because the British government have announced that if there's no agreement to restore the Stormont government by this evening, that they will effectively impose direct rule. It's some kind of unconscious echo of Catalonia.
What's going to happen with that then, if that actually does happen?
Well, it's months now since last January, I think, that the power sharing executive collapsed, and since then the civil servants have been running Northern Ireland. Well, they can continue to do so, but there is, at the moment, the budget is decided by Westminster, and the allocation of funds has to be decided by officials, not by politicians in Northern Ireland, because there's no executive to take decisions. And that's a deeply unhelpful and undemocratic procedure. But without the cooperation of the two major parties, we're stymied. When I was there, the two major parties were not the current major parties. They were David Trimble's Ulster Unionist Party and John Hume's STLP. And unfortunately, I think over a process of, roughly over the time I was there, the support for both those parties was hollowed out by Sinn Féin's successful hard line over decommissioning, which brought down David Trimble ultimately, because he had understood from the Good Friday Agreement that the IRA would decommission their weapons, and had sold the agreement to the unionist community on the basis of that. And of course that didn't happen on his watch. And so his party and his moderate influence was undermined. And the same thing happened on the nationalist side, where Sinn Féin cloaked their military past sufficiently well to, I think, con a lot of people into thinking that they were a genuine democratic movement. I don't think they are at all. I think the Sinn Féin, at the end of the day, will always be the political arm of the military council of the IRA, which still runs it.
And do you think, just judging by what you say, you know, it's hard for anyone really to sort of think, you know, is the situation in Ireland and, you know, question of a united Ireland just hopeless? Because you said that in the Good Friday Agreement, there was too many concessions to the IRA. You know, do you look back with regret or sort of any, you know, what do you feel about it? Like, how can you?
I mean, I said at the time that one of the things that completely undermined people like Trimble and the moderates was that the IRA were given the freedom of their prisoners, but they didn't have to give anything up in return, like decommissioning their weapons and their explosives and their arms dumps. And I said at the time the simplest way of dealing with it was to say to the IRA, or Sinn Féin, if you want your prisoners out, it'll be a perfectly straightforward mechanical process. We know roughly the inventory of what arms you have. And for the first 5% you decommission, you'll get 5% of your prisoners out, and the next 5% and the same. And it would have been a mechanical process. Instead, all the concessions were made on one side, and that was deeply damaging to the moderate unionist position.
And now, if we look at just specifically with the issue of the DUP, in bed with the Conservatives really in government, is that something that Theresa May should be doing really in the position in such a weak position that she's in?
I don't take such a kind of tragic view about it as some people. I mean, I think I've lived through minority governments and governments depending on nationalist support in the 1970s, and Scottish nationalists and Welsh nationalists supporting Labour, for instance, and then they've decided to pull the rug on it. These things happen. I think one accepts that as part of political life.
Surely that sort of undermines the process in itself, that she's actually giving, you know, all these concessions to the DUP when there's a crisis in Northern Ireland to begin with.
Well, she's not giving any concessions on the political side.
Surely when she's in government with them, really, that that is a sign.
Well, she's not in government with them. It's confidence and supply. It's not in government. There is not a single DUP minister in the Westminster government.
No, of course. But the point is that they're giving, you know, substantial amounts of money to their priorities. The DUP have influence that other political parties from Northern Ireland don't have. And people would argue.
Well, the money isn't going to the DUP or to one side of the communities in Northern Ireland. It's going to Northern Ireland. And frankly, you know, places like Scotland have had extremely generous handouts from Westminster for decades.
Mm. Yeah, but it's not. Yeah, but it's the issues that the DUP actually want to focus on, isn't it? Theresa May, you could argue, has, you know, sort of struggled onto power. You know, you could argue that it was sort of the safe thing to do for the country or whatever. But it's you know, do you agree that this perhaps means that it's difficult to actually find a solution for Northern Ireland if she, you know, is in a confidence and supply deal with one of the major parties like the DUP?
No, I think the two things run in parallel, and one can go forward and the other can be stuck, and I think that's where we roughly are at the moment.
Mm. And if we just look then, just going back to the Brexit negotiations in Northern Ireland specifically and the issues surrounding that, do you think there will be a hard border between Ireland and Northern Ireland?
No, I don't think so, but I'm baffled as to what the arrangements can be. And I think, as I said at the outset, I think if you don't know what the trading relationship between the Union and the UK is, I don't see how you can work out what the arrangements are. I've just spent the weekend in Dublin, as it happens, and people there are equally baffled as to what happens. There's some people talk of the border actually being at the Irish Sea, but of course that would be anathema to unionists of every hue and more besides, I think, in Northern Ireland.
And is there a case then for actually involving devolved administrations, or actually speaking to devolved administrations in these negotiations? Because many people, such as the First Minister of Wales, Cameron Jones, has argued that, you know, Theresa May doesn't care about the devolved administrations. It's just done from Westminster and Whitehall, and that's all that matters.
I don't see any real evidence for that. I mean, you know, the devolved administrations have been there in place now for a couple of decades, and overall people seem to like it that way. I think Westminster is glad in a way to be shot of the most of the major responsibilities. And the Welsh office and the Scottish office are kind of skeleton staffs, and I think that they're happy that it should be so.
Mm. And if we move on then to looking at something I want to talk about, which is diplomacy generally, because as I said in the introduction, that you are, you know, you've been all over the place. You know, you are one of the most experienced diplomats we have in this
country. Certainly one of the best travelled.
So, but if we look at it and we look at, you know, your career and everything like that, how have you seen the role of the Foreign Office change and the role of embassies and ambassadors change? Because obviously when you were, well, at the end of the 90s, when you were in, you know, Eastern Europe, you know, it was such a, you know, there's such a crisis. We were talking about Richard Holbrooke just before we came on, and a sort of a documentary about his life now after he died and everything. And it sort of glorifies the role of the ambassador as well as the significance of it. But, you know, how have you seen the role of embassies and ambassadors change and the Foreign Office generally?
You mean the British Foreign Office any Foreign Office?
Well, any Foreign Office involved in international relations.
Okay, well, I think obviously matters have changed significantly since, say, well, you could say the turn of the last century or the post-war period, because the rapid increase in air travel, the rapid increase in communications, where you can be in instant touch by all sorts of electronic means, from Skype to Twitter to whatever, with other parts of the globe. When I was in Belgrade, which is as recently as the 1990s, the communication system had virtually collapsed because of sanctions. It often took 10 or 12 goes to make a phone call from the embassy to the Foreign Office. And ultimately, time was pressing. There were great dramatic events taking place, British soldiers taken hostage in Bosnia, for instance, where I had to go out and try and grapple with that. And you can't hang around trying to make a single phone call if you have to wait 2 hours to do it. You have to make your own judgments. And that, in a sense, is very liberating for an ambassador. You know what the general policy direction is, and you can go out and do it yourself without constant nannying from home.
Mm.
But there's now a proliferation of international visits from heads of state, prime ministers, foreign ministers, etc., who are also in direct touch with their own opposite numbers in what they would call friendly capitals. You know, if there's a crisis in the Middle East, the British and French and German foreign ministers will probably talk to each other several times a day without involving the ambassador. So to that extent, the ambassador's role is much reduced. But in many cases where there's a serious problem to discuss at summit level, the embassy is the base camp. And without the base camp, you don't get to the summit.
And what did you enjoy doing most then? Did you enjoy the sort of experience in Dublin or in Rome or in Madrid? You know, where was sort of the highlight when you thought that I actually can exert a lot of influence here and I can actually make some change for the better?
Oh, well, I enjoyed Rome more than any other post, but that had nothing to do with the work. That had everything to do with the fact that Rome is the most wonderful city on the planet.
Mm.
But in terms of interest, nothing will compare to being in Belgrade during the Bosnian War and the descent into war in Kosovo, because that's where you try and make a difference. I mean, I'm rather gloomy about diplomacy. I see it as a kind of Sisyphean task where you're endlessly pushing your boulder uphill and watching it fall down again. I think very often all you're doing is managing problems rather than solving them. I mean, the Middle East is a classic case in point. I mean, I was in our Arabian department back in 1970, and I thought, surely there must be a way through of the Arab-Israel question. And here we are, nearly 50 years later, and we're further away now from a solution than we were in 1970, which is pretty depressing.
And so what do you think then, if you look at people like Trump, who you can quote one of the headlines that he's gutted the State Department there, really, and you said yourself that the British Foreign Office is perhaps too bureaucratic at times as well. So if you look across the pond and what he's trying to do, really, and not naming any sort of successors for the people he sacks, what message does that send about global diplomacy from one of the most powerful countries in the world?
Well, it's pretty disastrous. I mean, my friends and ex-friends who were formerly members of the State Department are in despair, but B, very glad they're not in the State Department at the moment. If you don't fund, I mean, what is so cretinous about that sort of approach of the American president is that diplomacy is the cheap way of doing things. If you have to deal with the consequences of a war, and if you have to deal with the consequences of rebuilding a society and a country which has been destroyed by war, it is hundreds of times more expensive than diplomacy to find a sensible way forward. The cost of the war in Iraq, for instance, is just immeasurable, and not to mention the 150 to 200,000 Iraqis who lost their lives as a result of the conflict and the immediate aftermath, or the succeeding aftermath, which continues till this day.
Mm. And then if you look back here in the UK, Boris Johnson, our foreign secretary, is that the sort of person that we need to have as our representative as the most senior diplomat arguably in our country?
Well, he's not a diplomat, of course. The trouble is, I think Boris Johnson thinks he's still a journalist, and he thinks that the amusing, witty headline is more important than serious negotiation, which is obviously much harder work and much less entertaining. I don't think you can run a foreign office on the basis of seductive newspaper headlines and clever clogs articles, which is what he seems to think.
Which perhaps undermines the diplomatic approach of this country generally.
Well, there was a withering article in the Times a couple of weeks ago about Boris Johnson saying he was the most despised foreign minister in Europe. And I think that partly is owed partly to his role in the Brexit campaign, but I think it also reflects the fact he's not respected at all.
And how is the, you know, just focusing on the British Foreign Office, how has the dynamic changed now because of how we have, anyway, we have Boris as the Foreign Secretary to begin with, but then we also have the Department for International Trade, the Brexit Secretary. How is the sort of the relationship, or is it a good thing, or is it something that has just completely undermined Foreign Office officials and everything?
Well, I mean, if you regard this as the most important negotiation since the Second World War, which arguably it is, the fact that it's not being conducted by the Foreign Office but by a new artificially created department seems to me to make the point. You know, if the Foreign Office aren't doing this, what are they doing?
But what are they doing then?
Well, I know they do. They seconded quite a few people to David Davis's department.
Yeah.
But it should be run out of the. If international negotiation should be run by the Foreign Office.
And if we look then at how, you know, we say that Boris Johnson thinks he's a journalist still, and many people would probably not disagree with you about that. Is it challenging then for us to see a future for the Foreign Office as a diplomatic and a sort of a respected institution and one of the big four corners of government, really, in this country?
Well, I hope it can recover. I mean, it goes through various low points where its opinion is ignored, and its experts are sidelined. I mean, the Iraq War was a good case in point, where the Foreign Office legal advisers, to a man and a woman, said, without a second UN Security Council resolution, this is an illegal war. And this wasn't the legal advisers' views were not just sidelined, but they were suppressed from the cabinet, which I think is a hugely damaging way of administering the governance of the country. And I'm still amazed that the Chilcot inquiry didn't make more of that fundamental fact.
And before we sort of wrap it up then, you know, when you were sort of finishing your career, and it's about a decade ago now, why did you call it a day, you know, after Rome? Why did you call it a day after then?
Well, I didn't have any option. I had to retire.
Yeah, but did you want to?
Well, let me put it this way. I'd done 38 years in the Foreign Office. I joined the Foreign Office as soon as I left Oxford in 1968. I went back to Oxford nearly four decades later. So I'd done 38 years. I'd lived and worked in nine countries. If anyone had said, "So, would you like to go on to another country?" I would have said, "No, I think I've had enough, actually." But if anyone had said, "We'd actually like you to stay in Rome for the rest of your life," I would have said, "Where do I sign?" The reason I left Rome and came back to Oxford was because, in those days, you had to retire at 60.
Yeah, and if your career is pretty spectacular, and for any sort of diplomat. But if you had to, we talked about what was the most challenging and Rome was your most enjoyable. But when you look back at that diplomatic career and you look at the books you've written, you've written many books on the different things you've done. You know, what's the most memorable moment or a period of time that really sort of put it all into perspective and made it worth being a diplomat and an ambassador?
Well, I suppose I go back to Yugoslavia in the middle of the Bosnian War, and I suppose the time I was trying to secure the release of British UN troops.
Yeah.
There were 300 taken prisoner by the Bosnian Serbs, of whom about 20% were British.
Yeah.
And I went to see Milosevic and spoke to him about how much pressure he could exert on the Bosnian Serbs. And he initially said, "Oh, well, I'll do what I can," but it didn't convince me very much. So I went to Bosnia myself and saw the Bosnian Serbs and threatened them with war if any harm came to any of our any of our troops. And they took it, I think, pretty seriously. Again, I think I did so without a huge amount of backing for that position. But I said, you know, the consequences would be dramatic and severe. They came out. And I think when I picked them up in a town called Novi Sad, about 100 kilometers from Belgrade, I had a great feeling of, you know, of achieving something concrete, even if you know, the final denouement of the Bosnian War was still to come.
Mm. Do you think then, just reflecting on the moment, you know, mentor's role that ambassadors like yourself, Holbrooke as well, played in all that, are we going to see that level of diplomacy being so effective in the future?
I think it will depend. You know, the Bosnian, the Yugoslav crisis was taking place, although it was taking place in a part of Europe, it wasn't a part of Europe that people had focused on very much. Mm. In remote parts of the world, there's still an opportunity, I think, for an ambassador to make a difference where there's a crisis. In Western Europe, I think it's much more limited, and you know, as indeed it is in North America. But there will be part of crisis in, you know, we're thinking back to the Falklands crisis and Argentina and so on. That's a place where I think an ambassador can still make a real difference, and that's why we go into the business in the first place.
Sir Ivor, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Pleasure.
So you've heard it all, really, today. Sir Ivor now has retired from president of Trinity College, haven't you?
Yes.
So enjoying it? Enjoying retirement?
I've never been a great committee man, and I think over the last 11 years at Trinity, I must have chaired about 1,000 committee meetings. So the freedom from that, not having to chair governing body, bursarial, all the other meetings, is a great relief. I might tell you as a kind of throwaway, when I first started at Trinity 11 years ago, I had a meeting with the students, with the JCR and the NCR. Mm. And I said, "So what's on your mind, guys?" And he said, "Well, two things, Sir Ivor." I said, "Really? Well, go on." "Well, one is the cost of laundry washes has gone up by 5p.
Very serious, yeah.
I said, "I see, fine." I turned to the bursars, who said, "Well, you know, it's an outside contractor, so, you know, what can we do? Nobody has to have their stuff washed there. You can go anywhere you like." So that was rather grumpily accepted by the student body. And I said, "Anything else?" "Yes, yeah, well, one other thing. The condom machine is broken." And I thought to myself, you know, not very long ago, I was trying to bring the Bosnian War to an end. And now I'm reduced to fixing the condom machine.
You know what? You know, we've got the future leaders of our country here, Sir Ivor, and this is what's important to them. I'm glad to see that your expertise is put to good use in Trinity
Absolutely.
College anyway. But thank you very much for coming and really appreciate your time. And next week we'll be speaking to even more interesting people around Oxford. We've got a few more interviews coming up with the NUS Vice President. We're also going to be speaking to Natalie Bennett very soon, former leader of the Green Party in England and Wales, and a few more guests before term ends. But from me and Sir Ivor and everyone here at Oxford Today at Oxide Radio, goodbye.
Oxide Radio, online and on demand. Listen back to all your favourite shows on oxideradio.live.